This is World Radio, KHOE 90.5 FM in Fairfield, Iowa, and this is the program What's New on Campus. And today we are celebrating Sweet Sunday, June 24th. And to start things off, here's Karen Ioka Olke, and she will introduce everybody as we go along. Karen?
My name is Karen Ioka, and right now I'm an assistant professor in Marshy Vedic Science. I was asked to interview David Orm Johnson, Dr. OJ, because he knows intimately the research behind the group effect of Marshy's Transcendental Meditation Program and the Advanced TM City Program. We also have two participants in the ongoing Invincible America Assembly, in which people volunteer their time to meditate for long hours in the Golden Dome. And we have two participants who will be sharing their personal experiences of participating in this assembly. Sai will be introducing the Sweet Sunday Initiative, something that started a couple months ago. So we'll start off the whole show by hearing from Sai.
Hello, my name is Sai Winter Tamaki. I'm a student at NUM, and I work in the NUM Tape Library. And so the whole focus of this show is to promote the Sweet Sundays, which, as Karen mentioned, was started in a few months ago in April. And this is a program to promote transcendental meditation and the TM City program, including yogic flying, the group practice. And so for this, it's usually held on the last Sunday of each month. And the siddhas will go to the dome or the various program halls around Fairfield and Vedic City, and afterwards sweets will be served for refreshments at the Golden Dome. And for meditators, there's a group meditation in the Men's Peace Palace in MUM. There will be a knowledge meeting on this Sunday at 4 o'clock, a group checking at 4:30, and the meditation will start at 5 o'clock.
Now we'll hear from two participants in the Invincible America Assembly. This is to give everyone a feel for the personal transformation or effects that can come from participating in group meditation. So although I'll be focusing later on the effects for world consciousness, right now first we're going to start off by just hearing what it's like to participate in group meditation every day. So we'll start off with Mark Roberts. Do you participate in the Patanjali Golden Dome? Is that where you do your program?
Yes, Golden Dome.
All right, so welcome to the show. I hear you've been here since 1974.
I have been on staff in NYU in Santa Barbara, California, where the university started. And when we bought this campus in Fairfield, we picked up and moved from Santa Barbara, I came along with the university.
All right, and you've been here ever since?
No, coming and going. But I've been here for the last 18 years.
And is this, how long have you been doing this latest streak of meditating in group, I guess, part of the Invincible America Assembly?
I was on vacation when it started in 2006, but I returned shortly after to Fairfield. And after I heard what it was about, I joined almost immediately. So I joined in August of 2006, and I've been doing the last 6 years consecutively, uninterrupted on the program.
How many have been in that same position?
I honestly don't know. But I know some have been since 2006 without interruption.
Yeah, I remember when the whole assembly started. I think it was called the Festival of Light, I remember.
Festival of Bliss and Light.
Do you have any particular experiences you wish to share?
Well, two reasons I joined the assembly. One is I simply enjoy group meditation ever since I learned TM in 1971. Second reason I like going to the dome for the program is that we discuss experiences, particularly back in 2006 when it started. Maharishi was commenting on people's experiences, and to me this was invaluable, just to have that opportunity to hear him speak directly, not just on having thoughts in meditation, but on better, higher experiences in meditation. So those are the two key reasons why I joined the Invincible America Assembly.
And now, what keeps you going every day?
What keeps me going every day? I'm very fortunate now that program is going well. If I think back to when I learned TM, there's no way from my experience that David would have asked me to share any experiences, because I didn't have any. Mm. When I learned TM, I had no experience other than I felt better in activity. It was that way for years. And I gradually, over time, with persistence during the program steadily, had breakthroughs, little breakthroughs, little breakthroughs. And finally, with the Invincible America Assembly, I actually have very clear transcending. I know what that is, what the higher self is, and bliss and other experiences like that. And the main benefit I would say I've gotten from the IA is understanding these inner experiences and therefore having greater self-confidence. Mm-hmm. And that carries on into activity, where I was always weak in self-confidence. I was always shy, reserved. If you're not lacking in self-confidence, you don't have any idea how that affects every aspect of life, whether it's your social activity, interviewing for a job, any number of things. And since particularly being on the IA, it has grown tremendously in both inner confidence and in outer activity. Another way it's really helped, just recently, I've had a number of breakthroughs, but just a few weeks ago I had an opening of the heart, is how I would refer to it. I've always been a nice guy, I think. I can say that safely. But, you know, there's a whole big difference between being able to tune into someone else's heart or have your own heart open and just being appreciative that someone is being nice, like my mom, or good friends, and really connecting on a heart level. And finally, after all these years, it happened in one meditation where this deep transcendence was there. My heart simply melted, opened, started flowing with love. And it has continued even in activity. So this is the type of experience that just keeps me going to the dome, hoping that more and more will just keep unfolding. Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. And it goes along with the model we're promoting with students right now. It's just that change begins within, and that it indeed does transform outer life. So this is the hypothesis, if you will, that we're putting forward to the students. And it's very encouraging to hear the effects of long-term practice. It does state in the Yoga Sutras that yoga unfolds over a long time with respectful practice. And I like to remind the students that you're kind of making minor adjustments every day. And then over time, it's like then you get these macro adjustments, and then you really see that, oh, every day there was some change happening. So that experience of the heart opening to me really signifies the effect of just every day diving in, diving out, and then you have these colossal shifts. It's very beautiful. And thank you for sharing, you know, this intimate aspect of participating in group grounding. So I'd love to hear, and just shift the attention now to Cindy, who's been participating in the Women's Dome. Is that where you've been doing your program, or are you out in Vedic City?
I'm out in Vedic City.
Down Vedic City, fine. So yeah, we have two golden domes, and then what is it, like seven flying halls around Vedic City Fairfield. Mm-hmm. So Cindy's out in Vedic City, and you have an interesting story. You say you're a little bit more recently participating. And when did you learn transcendental meditation?
In 2014.
Mm-hmm. Out in California.
In California, in Berkeley, California.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that ended up saving my mental life, my life. I was a CFO of our own corporation and done that for almost 20 years. And being in business and being in California in business is extremely difficult.
Yeah.
So lots and lots of stress and tension and things.
Mm-hmm.
So I was feeling mentally I was becoming unstable. And somehow I miraculously found TM on the internet. No one did I know had ever heard of it or had any experience of it. And so I started doing more research, became a meditator, and because I couldn't seem to get rid of the stress that came along with my job and running, you know, 27 employees and such and crews and things going on, mm-hmm. I kept advancing and taking the next advanced technique. As soon as the time was up and they let me take it, I'd take the next one and the next one. So I took six of them. And finally, when I got to the sixth one, although I was feeling better and more secure about things, I still felt like I was kind of on the edge of, too close to the edge. So then I took the Cities program, and that would have been, graduated out of there of June of 2016.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the first...
2 years ago.
2 years ago.
Yeah.
And then things got fantastic, got lot better. But there was a draw to Fairfield because the times that you come and you experience a group meditation, it draws you back into it. So my husband is not a Siddha. He is a TM person.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, why don't we go and move to Iowa for a while? Let's try out Fairfield. I think we might like it. He said, okay. So in May of 2017, I moved out before him. He had some medical issues he still had to conclude. And I've been here for a year now. I was bestowed being the manager of the flying hall out at Ideal Life Campus.
Mm-hmm.
But I love it here. It's amazing. And the thing that I noticed coming from a corporate perspective or from the world where it's always pushing and driving and you have to keep on top of everything, is that, first of all, the TM helped tremendously in keeping me on an even keel. But then, as I mentioned, going further into the advanced techniques and then finally becoming a Siddha, it put me in a different realm. And that realm, I can tell, mostly, more specifically, when I'm in group. I always make a point of being in group meditation. I do not meditate on my own.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always there. And it's amazing, the larger the group, because I don't go to the dome, but I can imagine in the dome, I've been there, how it just, the volume of people and your proximity close, that your whole dynamics of what you feel and what you come away with is amazing. You think differently. You have your mind that calculates and tells you answers without even being able to figure out where it came from. Just all of a sudden, you got it. My son and my husband just started an LLC for which I've been guiding them along that and starting a new company and such. It's just, it comes out. It's like rolling off my tongue, you know, this and this and this and this. And I'm thinking, wow, where'd that all come from? Usually it would take me a while to think about it, and it just flows. So my kids are calling me going, Mom, what do you think about this? And I'll just, you know, let nature take me, and it just goes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. And my brain is turned into this sponge, this huge sponge. I used to like to know things before. Now it's like I cannot wait a minute to find out something new about something else. It might be, somebody told me something about dandelions. I went and did research on the internet. It was like, wow, the benefits on all of them and what's going on. And LLC, I was the person that did the research on it, and it just absorbed me, and it was fascinating. Instead of the usual self that would have said previously, okay, here we go. You know, you just got to put it to the grind. You got to make sure you do it. You have to cross the T's, dot the I's. And it was work. And this is more like a thirst.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot nicer area to come from, out in the world every day, or just being home and enjoying things around you. I see new things in the trees and the grass around me and the animals and how they respond to me and such. It blows me away. I get amazed every single day. The benefits can't be denied. They just really can't if you just sit there and let it go. And you get all the benefits in the world that you couldn't even start imagining. This is only like the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. And how do you feel about, you said you're previous to this, you thought you were kind of on the edge, but not quite getting to the bottom of the stress. And how do you feel about that pile of stress now?
amazingly different, because I swore when we closed, finally got rid of our business and such, and I swore I'm never going to do business again. I've had it. I never want to do this. And then when my son and my husband started saying, you know, we might have to do an S-corporation or an LLC, and it was like inside me went, oh, okay. It was just, oh, okay, which one is it? Let's go find out. S-corp is what we had, so I thought, I better find out about an LLC. And there was that thirst. And then, like, drinking some nice, fresh water when you get the information. A whole different concept than the way my mind handled it before.
So it's like you're still dynamic, but it's just that your actions are coming from a different place.
Yes, yes. I haven't doled out or anything, which was one thing I kind of was a little bit worried about getting to mellow and everything, but it's not. It you do get the silence, and you get the dynamism, and the two together are just unbelievable, and however you want it to be for your life, it can be huge, monstrous.
A good message to put out there that this is, even rounding is not necessarily a wreck for this life. You can still be fully functional with family and responsibilities. So
exactly.
Very encouraging.
Yes.
Perfect. So, all right, so now we've heard a bit of what it's like on the inside participating in the group. We're going to switch gears. Let's see if we can edit out this part. Okay. That was perfect. All right. Now we're going to switch gears, and we're going to go through a set of questions that I received from Professor John Collins, who just taught a course on world peace. And this is a course under the Marshi Vedic Science Department that looks at the science behind group practice of the Advanced TM City program and Transcendental Meditation. So we're going to be speaking to Dr. David Orm Johnson, and he's going to be taking what we call the challenging questions. So I have a list that I'll be going through. Before we start, I'd like to know a little bit more about you and how you started with researching the effects of Transcendental Meditation in the TM City program.
I first heard about TM from my best friend in high school, and who I've known about 14 years. By that time, I was just about to finish my PhD in graduate school, and I went to visit him in New York City. And every time I saw him over the years, he was into something new, you know. He was hanging out with the shamans, the Native Americans in Northern California, in New Mexico, and he was exploring recreational drugs at one point, and, you know, this is the 60s. So this time, he opens the door in New York, this is about 1968, and he's the most sort of settled. There was some vibe about him that was different. He was more settled. He had less of these sort of complicated things. He was like his real self, not pretending to be a Native American or something else. And he was being productive. He was interested in being a writer, and he was writing and doing these things. And so, what are you doing this time? It was Transcendental Meditation. He had come to hear. He's living in New York, but he went to see Maharishi when Maharishi was traveling with the Beach Boys, and actually he became friends with the Beach Boys, with Mike Love in particular after that. But anyway, I just wanted to meditate, and then when he went to do his TM, I went in the room and I just did, you know, whatever I could think meditation might be. But there weren't any teachers around at that time, and I got my PhD. I was teaching at the University of Texas in El Paso, and I was walking by a bulletin board and had a little note on it, and my head was like physically moved. I never looked at bulletin boards, but and it said, "Want to enjoy life more? Lecture on Transcendental Meditation." And I thought, that's what my friend was talking about. And I wrote down the details. I got my bike, rode it to go to the lecture, and I felt that same vibe in the teacher, this sort of evenness and everything. And so that afternoon, we were in the park with our son, and I was always very sort of uncomfortable in open spaces and everything, and I felt completely at ease and in the moment. And my wife wrote and noticed it right away, and she said, "Now I want to learn," but she had to wait 6 months until the teacher came back to town, because they, you know, they just came. And I was doing research and teaching at the university, and I thought, you know, this is really a great thing. It needs research on it. And one of the things I experienced was this greater stability, sort of emotional or autonomic. Or the autonomic nervous system controls all the vital functions of respiration and heart rate. Those are the things that go up when you're anxious. And Dr. Keith Wallace's study at UCLA had just come out, showing that the physiological effects of TM were just in the opposite direction of the anxiety response and the fight or flight response. You know, when you have to deal with challenges, that during TM, respiration slows down, the blood pressure slows, you know, decreases, heart rate slows down. So I was experiencing these things myself, and I was thinking, you know, this is really great, but it needs more research on it. I was like, yeah, so I ended up, you got to watch out what you think. So I ended up doing publishing 100 papers on TM. But the first one, I was doing a classroom demonstration on Pavlovian conditioning and how playing loud noises in people's ears and seeing how fast they recovered from that stress. And I noticed the meditators recovered faster. Then I started reading about the literature, and I found that there's a major measure called autonomic stability. If you turn the sensitivity of the machine up, which is measuring perspiration on the hand, for example, which is part of the stress response, that the meditators are making much fewer of these responses when they were just sitting with their eyes closed than the control group, people of similar age and so forth. And when they meditated, it decreased even more. So then, so that was the beginning of my research on TM. But one of the things I noticed, to get to the topic of the day, from the very first of TM course, part of the course is that you learn individually, you have individual instruction, and then you come back 3 days after that and to get more information about the whole thing, the nuts and bolts of the whole, you know, how you time that and what you do if someone knocks on the door and, you know, all these kinds of things. But we always had group meditations as part of the whole process. And like I said, I was a very kind of, like Mark said, very shy person and very uncomfortable around people. And so I'd be in this room with these about 10 or 15 strangers, most of them younger students. I was all 29 at the time. These were like my students' age. And when we all meditated together, this vibe was amazing. And then I would just sort of settle within. I was aware of people around, but you're totally kind of absorbed within in your own kind of bliss during TM, and I kind of forgot they were there. And then when it was time to come out of meditation, suddenly it was a different world. It was just everybody, it was like, so the atmosphere was kind of filled with this very soft kind of blissful feeling, mm-hmm. which you feel inside during meditation. But now it was the whole community of people sitting mm-hmm. there together. And so that hooked me on group meditation, and the opportunity came up within the first 2 weeks to go to a weekend retreat in Tucson, where we got to do meditations in groups and together, and it was just fantastic. I just remember I was just so blown away by the whole experience and being with the group and meditating longer and with the group. It just expanded my awareness. And when we drove back to El Paso across the desert, 50 miles or something, I felt like I was in IMAX movie.
Yeah.
It was like everything was so expanded. Mm-hmm. And then we stopped at this gas station and convenience store, and this was 1970, and there was this hippie bus. This was from the days of electric Kool-Aid acid tests. And these were like, I don't know where they were from, but imagine California. And they were hippies, and the bus was all painted, you know, with all these gaudy things, and they were dressed, you know, with very skimpily. And there was this sort of tension between the Arizona kids, who were like the very Goldwater conservative kids, and then these hippies, you know, and they were like, the Arizona girls were like shooting daggers, you know, and the hippie girls were kind of not even noticing, they're going around looking at things. And I thought there was this whole division in our society at that time between the generations. You don't trust anybody over 30. I was right on the borderline there at 29. And I saw that this was a solution to the, you know, it just made people so much more comfortable. And on the residence course, we have people of all ages meditating together, as well as all colors,
right.
People of all ethnicities.
Residence course of
and this was a time when, you know, the generations weren't getting along, you know, and the blacks versus the whites, and you know, the generation gap. And here, when they were meditating together in a group, it was this whole different world. The people were communicating, were having meaningful discussions. I remember some lady, she was an older lady, she was probably like 50 or something, you know. I was very impressed with that, and the group meditations were just really very central to creating magnifying the effect of the meditation on the, you know, me personally, and as well as how I interacted with people around me.
Right. So that addresses the first question, which was what do you personally get out of group meditation?
Yeah.
And, you know, why not just meditate at home? And it kind of goes with the second question here, which is, is there any research showing that group meditation is better?
Well, I did a study once when I was teaching psychophysiology here at Marshy University of Management.
Mm-hmm.
And there were 10 students in the class, and we had a polygraph to measure the respiration of 11 people.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, there was a 12 channel with a bent marker, so when I pushed a button, it made a mark on the chart. So these 11 pins were all drawing out people's breaths going up and down. So what I did was, is we all meditated together in a group, and at one point I felt like it just got really silent and deep in the meditation, and I pushed the button so it would mark on the pin where I felt that. And when we went and looked at the record afterwards, we saw that all of the breath rates slowed down at that moment. So it's like the whole group collectively transcended.
Mm-hmm.
Transcended means that you just settle down to the very, very quiet level of the mind. You know, the mind has different levels, and there's this very quiet, and TM just takes you to that quietest level. And as the mind settles down, the body settles down, the breath slows down. And so that you can physiologically, you know, see that. So you can see the meditating together in a group, that we all kind of settled in together, and it really amplified the effect. And I told Maharishi about this study, and his comment was, is that this is a whole different way that people can sit together. You know, they sit together to talk, they eat, they play, they have fun, and this is another dimension to it, where it's just very profound inner silence that you get together, which is the ground, really, for having very meaningful relationships and discussions and creativity and so forth.
Is that mark a change in how Maharishi promoted meditation? I think my understanding was at first he was thinking in terms of teaching individuals, but then with the research came the idea, oh, we can actually achieve more by...
An individual practice, you know, as you learn individually and so forth. But even in 1970, before there was any emphasis on group meditation, there was a little pamphlet that talked about, it was just very simple, and talked about that there are advanced techniques that we will be doing in groups.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of gave this hint of something to come in the future. But the idea of group, of doing it in groups, actually, the research on that actually, and the experience of that actually didn't sort of come to fore very clearly until 1978. And what happened was, Maharishi held an ideal society campaign that he had been emphasizing for some time, that even 1% of a population practicing TM would have an effect on the entire collective consciousness. And that scientists said, yes, there are many systems in nature in which few elements in a system working together coherently sort of sets the pace for the whole system. For example, in the heart, you have these pacemaker cells that sets the pace of the whole system. But the idea up to that point was 1% of the population distributed, you know, practicing in their homes. So what happened in 1978 is that the groups of TM teachers during the summer went to selected provinces and states. So in the United States, it was Rhode Island and Washington State, and it was Quebec and the one at the other end of the anyway. And And what was found was is that when the teachers meditated together in a group, fewer needed to have the same effect as more distributed throughout society. It became like the square of their effect. It's like in a physical system, if you have laser lights, you know, pulsing, if you put them close together with each other, they begin to reinforce each other, and then their effect becomes proportional to their number squared. So, you know, like if you have 10 together, they have an effect like 10 squared, which would be 100. Or, for example, if you have people in a tug of war, and you have 100 people kind of pulling randomly at one end, and you have only 10 people at the other end pulling on the rope all together coherently, they have a bigger effect. Mm-hmm. So the idea was is that the square root of 1% of a population practicing together in a group would be powerful enough to begin to override the incoherent and chaotic influences in society, and it would change the trends of time.
Now we're talking about the Marsh effect.
That's called the Marsh effect. And it was discovered, scientists said, you were trying to think of a name up for it, and one of the scientists said, Dr. Jeffrey Clements from England said, we should call this the Marsh effect. And it was we all thought, that's a good idea, because he predicted it and he made the techniques available for that.
And that's specifically for the 1% effect?
The Marsh effect was, for the 1%, and then when the group effect was named the extended Marsh effect.
So something I usually have to clarify a number of times for the students, that Marsh effect refers to this 1% of the city, not necessarily in a group.
No, that's
right. Scattered throughout. And the extended Marsh effect is specifically group practice.
Yeah, that's right.
Of TM or the advanced?
Group practice of TM is also good, as I found in resonance courses and, you know, just when you're going to meditate.
Mm-hmm.
But to have the effect on society, it's good to have the most advanced technique, which is a TM, Transcendental Meditation Study Program, and Yogi Fly.
Should just mention that resonance courses are now TM retreats.
Yeah, they're the TM retreats, okay.
Yeah.
All
right, so we have another question, and it's, how do you know that the effect is from Transcendental Meditation, as in the Marsh effect, and that it's not from some other factor?
Okay, well, that's what everybody wants to know, and you have a very complex system. Like, for example, you're measuring crime rate.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's known that there are many things that affect crime. For example, the percentage of young men from 18 to 25 in the population. The more young men you have, the more violent crime you have. So, or economic factors. For example, economic turndowns when there's unemployment or poverty. And our education levels. And so all of these different factors you have to take into account when we do a study on the Marsh effect, and now there's been over 50 of them. There's a way to take out the influence of all these different things. And so, for example, a study that Dr. Michael Dilbeck did,
mm-hmm.
and published in a good journal in 1987 now, or 88, he took a random sample of 80 statistical metropolitan areas. What that means is like you have New York City, the city boundary, but the actual reality of the population is spread out all over Boswash, you know. And so now statisticians, for demographic reasons, they talk about cities, populations in terms of cities, but also in the broader outline. So this took into account over half of the metropolitan, his study took into account over half the metropolitan population in the United States, and over a several year period, and he showed that as the number of meditators in the population increased, the crime rate decreased, taking into account all of these other factors which are known to affect crime rate, like the number of young men, the unemployment rate, the state of the economy, and so forth. And so that's how you do it. You have to find some way to control for other things.
Right.
And another way you can do it is you could pick a time, like an hour, you know, just say, okay, you can announce ahead of time, as we did this in Washington, D.C. in 1993, and say, okay, we're going to do this study. This is what we're going to be looking at. We're going to be looking at crime rate and various other factors. And so you put your money on the line, so to speak. you know, and we got an outside project review board, who were people outside of the TM movement, members of the police department, members of the community, members, people from other universities, to say they would monitor the research. And yes, we, you know, we gave them our research protocol, and we're going to be here at this time, and this is what we expect to see. And then we got the statistics, and then it showed out that it worked. You know, the crime rate in Washington decreased by 23% by what, from what was predicted to happen at that time.
So if one wanted to look up these studies.
Yes, it's the data is all objective. The papers are published in peer-reviewed journals, and the journal editors are experts in the methodology. I'll let you go through your questions.
Well, we've actually gone through a number of them.
I know.
That's pretty good. Here's number six. Talking about, is it true that any theory can be proven with statistical research? So does the expectation of the researcher actually influence the result?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. And, of course, researchers all expect, you know, they all have expectations. They're, that's where they're doing their research, whatever it is.
Right.
But there's all kinds of checks and balances in science to make sure that it is done objectively. And so one that I mentioned is you say ahead of time, you know, what you're going to do, and you specify what the measures are, and you specify how you're going to control for the different things. But it's kind of pop wisdom that statistics can prove anything, and in the hands of politicians, it seems to be true. but what they mean by that more is that there's all kinds of facts out there, so you can pick this fact, you can cherry pick. You know, so that's one issue. Are you cherry picking your data? Did you do 20 studies? You found one of them came out. You put the rest in a file drawer, and you just showed us this one. But see, when you say ahead of time what you're going to do, then you can't do that. You put it on the line. You're going to measure these things, and it's all public data, so anyone can get the data and look it up. And you know, and we share data here. Here's what we did. This is what we found. So you know, you can't prove any. Statistics is much more constrained than that, and people who know statistics and the editors of journals and the reviewers are expert in these statistical methodologies, so they know all of the things that could be wobbled this way or that, and they look at the methodology, and what they said about our methodology is that it's very good. Even though, you know, they can't, the theory seems so unusual. I can quote from a couple of editors from journals that said, if I apply the criteria I would normally use to judge any other example of traditional research, I would recommend publication. This was the editor, a reviewer for the Journal of Conflict Resolution, which is the top journal in that field, and they published our study that we did in the Middle East in 1988, and the editor said, the hypotheses seemed logically derived from the initial premises, and its empirical testing seems competently executed. These are the standards to which manuscripts submitted for publication in this journal are normally subjected. The manuscript, either in its initial version or in revisions, was read by 4 referees, 2 more than is typical for this journal, 3 psychologists and a political scientist. And actually, it turns out that Carla Linton Brown at Harvard did her dissertation on how people reacted to this study, and what she found out, there were actually, in the end, there were 6 reviewers, and including the editor, and 5 of them were experts in time series analysis, is what we did. Mm-hmm. And they all said that, you know, this is unbelievable, but, you know, that they did it really well, and that's why we'll publish it.
What is the referee? What is that?
A referee is when you submit a scientific paper to a journal, you have people who are expert in that field, and the methodologist, and in the area of study. So if it's a paper in heart disease, then a bunch of doctors who are experts in heart disease will read your paper, and they know the field very well. They know all the people you're referring to, and those are the referees, and they read it, and they make a recommendation to publish or not publish, or to, if you revise this and this and this, if you can answer this and this and this, we'll reconsider it. Those are the things that happen to you when you submit to a journal.
Time. We're running really short on time here, actually. He's got a whole bunch of questions here.
We can go indefinitely.
I think I'm just answering them as we go.
But you know, people don't listen to the radio more than 45 minutes or an hour. You know, they tune out.
Yeah,
that's been my experience. So we should really abbreviate this as much as possible.
Okay.
We've been here for
good, right?
Huh?
I mean, do you want to cover more?
Somebody told me this is going to go on for 2 hours, so I'll try.
Well, I could pick out just two or three more questions.
No, why don't you just go through them and I will be brief.
Yeah? Does that work?
Yeah, well, yeah.
All right.
I think we can do it in 20, 25 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right.
All right.
You can time it. Yep.
Okay. We're going to move pretty efficiently to the rest of the questions. The next one is, what makes any of the TM research scientifically irrefutable? Is it the time series analysis?
Well, time series analysis is one point. What that does is shows that what happens during the Marsh effect is not due to some other factor. So that's a very powerful piece of evidence that it is true.
All right. Is there any research showing physiological changes among non-meditators in the vicinity of yogic fun groups?
Yes, as a matter of fact, there are. There was a study done here in Fairfield at MUM in which it was found that there was a correlation between how big the group was and the change in serotonin, which is kind of the happiness hormone, in people in the vicinity who were not meditating, and also reduction in stress hormones. So the bigger the group meditating here, the happier as far as their hormones show, and lower the stress of people in the community.
All right. And what is your favorite Marsh effect study and why?
I think the one that we did in the Middle East, where we showed that when we created a group in the Middle East in the 2 month period, that there was a reduction in war and an improvement in quality of life in Israel in that area, it's very strongly correlated with how big the group was. The bigger the group, the bigger the effect, and that has ended up yielding 4 different publications. Because people keep trying to find something wrong with it, and it gives us a chance to go more deeply into it and to go more deeply into the analysis. So that's kind of like, and that one was predicted ahead of time with the project review board and so forth. So that was really one of my favorite studies.
Right. What were you doing in the 1978 World Peace Project?
During the World Peace Project, what it was Marshy sent groups of men, meditators, to various trouble spot countries in the world throughout Central America and Africa and the Middle East. And I went around and talked to government leaders in Latin America, along with Keith Wallace and Steve Drucker and Larry Domes, physicist Larry Domes.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to talk to presidents, and it was very interesting to be there and to see firsthand how the whole country became calmer.
Yeah.
And in that situation, it was the revolutionaries who saw that we were making the country calmer. So anyway.
Were you part of the group practice?
I meditated. We meditated with the group when we were there, but we didn't stay for it. We just moved on to other countries.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I ran around and did that.
It's a cool mission. Were there any studies that Marshy didn't want to publish for any reason?
No, we published everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some studies, like the one in the Middle East, The Marsh effect has a stronger effect on some variables than others, which in itself is very interesting. You know, some were just sort of like on fires and auto accidents. The effect was fairly weak. But we've discovered that on variables that involve the country as a whole, like war, so in war, the whole country is involved in a conflict compared with, say, crime rate, in which it's an individual. And so the effect on war of the collective entity of the nation as a whole was approximately twice as strong as on the individuals within the nation, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
So the Marshy Effect is like, it's like the collective consciousness of a country is like, it's like an entity, and it affects that bigger entity more than the individuals within it.
I see.
We found that consistently over many studies.
Well, do you think the scientific research has made any difference to our progress to creating world peace? If so, how?
Oh, well, the difference that it makes is that it kind of gives some objective feedback to what's going on. Otherwise, after the fact, when something happens, people make all kinds of great theories of why it happened with their 20/20 perfect hindsight.
Yeah.
So, for example, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union or the end of the Cold War, everyone was astounded.
Mm-hmm.
But then afterwards, it's all everybody has theories and written books. Oh yeah, this is why it happened. So the research, you know, especially prospective, when you see, you know, you can say ahead of time what's happened.
Is there any research being done on the peace-creating effect of the world peace yes? I suppose you have to define that a little bit.
The peace yagyas. There are other technologies besides group meditation for creating peace, and that's being monitored and in progress.
Okay.
Nothing completed.
Right. Does anyone know the relative power of yogic flying compared with these world peace yagyas?
No. Not yet.
Given that there are multiple large groups of siddhas and also of yogic performances in the world, all of which are creating their effects, is it still possible to do a Marshy Effect study?
Well, that's a good question. The effect is localized to a certain extent, but time will come when the whole world is very coherent and peaceful, and then there won't be any contrast. You know, that's just how things will be. But right now what's happening is that there are large groups that have been created throughout Central America and in Africa and other places, and that's being studied, what happened during those times. For example, in Peru, since 1992, when they started really teaching TM and with group program, people meditating together, the whole world, the whole country has been totally transformed from a place where people don't want to be there. Now that they're loving it, they're very proud of being there. The whole economy's gotten better. It's peaceful. We've got a lot of civil war. Now it's, you know, because they don't.
And my understanding is these schools have signed on to not only learn TM, but the whole thing. So they have to agree to also do the yogic flying.
Yes, it's part of the school routine that all the students meditate and they practice the advanced techniques together.
Mm-hmm. And that's where you really see the...
Yeah, and then this country is really changing. We recently had a great presentation by Javier Ortiz, our TM national leader in Peru. And it was just amazing how all these kids meditating together and the transformation that it's made in Peru.
Yeah. Have you ever been able to persuade a non-meditator about the field effect, or the unified field paradigm?
Yes, there are some professors who are not meditators and who read our research and have been very impressed by it. For example, Ted Gurr, who's a professor of emeritus in political science at University of Maryland, he said, "In the studies I've examined on the impact of the Marshy Effect on conflict, I can find no methodological flaws, and the findings have been consistent across a large number of replications in different geographic regions and conflictual situations." And another example is Dr. David Edwards, professor of government at the University of Texas. He said, "The claim can plausibly be made that the potential impact of the Marshy Effect research exceeds that of any other ongoing social or psychological research program. The research has survived a broader array of statistical tests than most research in the field of conflict resolution. I think this work and the theory that informs it deserves the most serious consideration by academics and policymakers alike."
Wow. Okay. So I think it helps maybe that you're a scientist, though, right?
Yeah.
Or have you, yeah. Can we have a $1 billion GoFundMe for the global group, the world group?
Well, that would be a great idea. If someone figured out how to organize it, go on to Facebook.
Yeah, go ahead. Put this back on the students. Is there any personal experience that you have had that you've had to make? I don't think this question is worded very well. I think it has something to do with, do you have any personal experience to verify the efficacy of the Marshy effect?
Well, I think we all have personal experiences. You know, I actually, when I first heard about this idea of people influencing each other at a distance, mm-hmm. was when I was about 12 years old, and I had this aunt who was very beautiful. She was my mother's younger sister, going to college, staying with us in El Paso. And she came home one day. She had this flashy red convertible. She came home. She was so excited. She said, "I was sitting in the root beer stand with my friends, you know, outdoors where you're served outside, sitting in her convertible, and she felt like someone was looking at her. She couldn't get over it. She's looking around. Finally, she sees these guys on the other end of the parking lot with binoculars."
Mm.
So she had experienced this influence of someone, you know, putting attention on her from a distance. And so I was very impressed with that story. And since then, there's been a lot of research showing that people do influence each other at a distance. You know, stare at someone, they do actually feel it, and you can measure it physiologically.
Mm.
So that, you know, that, yeah. and then you know, teaching about collective consciousness in the classroom, I would always begin asking them to think if they had any stories that would be their homework, and everybody came with some story. Like, one girl said that she had this dream that her father, that she was in the United States and her father was in Russia, and she dreamed he was sick, and her brother in Europe had the same dream, and it all turned out to be true. They were all connected, you know.
Yeah.
And many, many people have stories with their family, especially mothers and their kids. Mothers are constantly tracking their kids, you know. They know, you know, what are you doing?
They distinctively know.
Yeah, they're connected.
Yeah. Has anyone conducted EKGs to monitor heart rate variability or heart coherence during transcendental meditation?
Well, brain coherence we've measured, and also heart rate variability, yes, during TM. But I think the interesting thing is that Dr. Fred Travis has done a study where he had people meditate, a person meditating in one room and doing the yogic flying, and the person in another room working in a computer, and they didn't know about each other.
Mm-hmm.
And when the one doing the yogi flying was doing yogi flying, it created coherence in the brain of the person at the computer. The coherence in the yogi flyer led in time the coherence mm-hmm. in the person at the computer. So it showed that there was a connection between the two different people physiologically, positive connection of increased orderliness of brain functioning.
It's more EEG.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This was a question about EKG, but...
Yeah, I know. I didn't say EKG. Yeah, EKG means the heart rate, and not studies on that.
Okay.
But on brain coherence.
Okay, this is the last question. Has the CIA or other government agencies investigated your Marshy effect activities?
Probably. Probably KGB as well.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a group that first went to and taught in Russia in 1989-1990.
Yeah.
And so we went in under the auspices of Intel. What did it call it? Not Intel. Intourist.
Mm.
And it turns out that if you go to the Soviet Union at that time, you had to go through Intourist, and they would conduct you around and show you stuff, you know, to keep track of you. And then I found out that it was a KGB operation, so they obviously were very aware of us. And then we found out that to get into there, we went to the Soviet Union, and the Soviet embassy in Washington, and we talked to this guy, Mr. Nanagulian, and he was a young man in his 50s, say. And he said, they gave us permission to go. Anyway, and he said, and when you're there in Yerevan, the capital of Armenia, where we're going for earthquake relief, say hello to my father, Mr. Nanagulian Sr. So Dr. Bob Wynn and I, who every week we would go talk to Mr. Nanagulian Sr., who was this really nice guy. And then when we're getting ready after 6 months of being there and teaching 40,000 people TM for earthquake relief, which is an amazing story in itself, I mentioned to my translator, who was a physicist, oh, I have to go say goodbye to Mr. Nanagulian Sr. He looks really surprised. He said, do you know who Mr. Nanagulian Sr. is? He's the head of KGB Section 4, Counterintelligence. he runs into us. He said, if you look at pictures of Brezhnev's visit to Washington, D.C., you'll see Mr. Nanagulian standing next to him.
Oh, that's true.
So they knew what we were doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, any kind of large movement, I think, that the various intelligence agencies in the different countries want to keep track of.
Yeah.
So, but they don't know specifically,
mm-hmm.
you know, if they do or not. Hopefully they do. Hopefully they're paying close attention and listening, you know.
Mm-hmm. What do you foresee as, like, the future of research on transcendental meditation and group practice?
Well, there's still a long way to go to explaining it theoretically in terms
yeah.
of modern science will that's completely integrated with what's known in modern science.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is, in order to explain the Marsh effect, you have to know everything about physics and consciousness, because it's consciousness having an effect on physics. And so as physics evolves, you know, you learn more about it, and the research will keep going on and on until we get to that point where we have a complete understanding of consciousness and the physical world and how they interact. And what happens is as one part of the Maharishi effect, it's not just reducing crime rate and war, it's increasing creativity and creative intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see all this amazing developments, for example, in electronics and imaging, brain imaging, and as more technologies come up for finding out subtler things about how the brain works, for example, immediately gets applied to meditation, and then you start going deeper and deeper. So the whole thing will keep evolving to deeper,
right.
deeper levels. But the really good news is that that our calculation is that it takes about groups of 10,000 to create coherence for the whole world, and there's several such groups coming up. So we foresee a very, very happy ending to this whole story, and a long era of peace, world peace. There'll still be lots of jolts and jerks as the old way of doing things gets sorted out into a new way of doing things. You know, things will turn over, but hopefully it will all happen in a peaceful way, and we're going to have world peace.
Thank you for bringing all of this to life. It's much more interesting looking at scientific research with someone who actually has lived through it.
Thank you.
Do you have any other questions?
No.
Right.
Well, I would ask Sai, you know, just
yeah.
to put it on tape. You know, what is your experience group meditation? You're one of the superstars, flyers.
Oh. Well, you know, it just brings a great deal of fulfillment for me, and you know, I feel like I've become more resilient. That's a primary thing, you know, that you know, no matter the stresses, the difficult times that come up, you know, being part of a group really helps me to get through that, and you know, and to grow and get the most out of it, to learn the most from each experience. And so I feel really blessed to have this opportunity. So we were really fortunate because to have this talk today, which we're really what we're wanting to do is to celebrate and our enjoyment of this beautiful program of transcendental meditation and the TM Cities program, which Maharishi brought out through the grace of Gurudev and the holy tradition of Vedic masters. We had a taste of the success that these programs bring, both the inner satisfaction and the outer achievement, as told through the stories of our IA participants, Invincible America, both Mark and Cindy. And through our wonderful interview with Dr. David Orm Johnson, we got to hear about the stories of the studies of these universal benefits, both for the individuals and for the whole society. And I also want to emphasize just the strength of these studies. I mean, he's such a humble man that we can't sometimes appreciate how powerful it is. But you know, because this is a new paradigm, and there was so much resistance to accepting this, you know, non-local action of being able to create peace just by, you know, sitting still and acting from the level of the unified field. These scientists, these pioneers of the Age of Enlightenment, really had to have their studies at a very high standard. And correct me if I'm wrong, but what I've heard is that, you know, these studies, the Marshy effect is one of the most statistically well-supported figures in all of social sciences.
That's right, yeah, it's been repeated many times, and the p-value is astronomically small, which means very unlikely that it just was a fluke.
That we're more certain of the Maharshi effects than we are of the exact weight of an electron.
Yeah.
That's one way I've heard it put. It's really incredible. So we just all want to enjoy this program by and celebrate it by with these sweet sundaes. They're usually going to be the last Sunday of each month, the upcoming one for June. It's on Sunday the 24th. And so just come to the group program halls. We'll have refreshments at the Golden Dome. Oh, and this is in the afternoon program, the PM. And that's for siddhas. And for meditators, we'll have a group program at the Men's Peace Palace. This is on the west side of Highway 1 in MUM. At 4 o'clock, we'll start with a knowledge meeting. With 4:30, there'll be the group checking. And at 5 o'clock, there'll be the group program. So thank you very much. Oh. And also, be sure to come to the talk given by Dr. David Orme Johnson at the Phoenix Hall on, it'll be Wednesday the 20th of June this month at 7:30 p.m. So we hope to see you all there, and thank you very much. Jai Guru Dev.
So, it was so wonderful, you know, this meeting today, because we have such a disparity of ages here, the young and David and I. But, you know, but it's so wonderful to see this happening, because this is Maharshi's vision, to seeing, you know, the age of enlightenment come to fruition. I think this is what's happening. As you pointed out,
yeah,
you know, whether we want it or not, it's coming. And so just to be able to enjoy it while we have it here and enjoy these programs. So I just want to say thank you, Karen. Thank you, Sai. Thank you, David. And you have been listening to the program What's New on Campus here on KHOE 90.5 FM. Thank you, and see you this sweet Sunday, June 24th. Jai Guru Dev.